Parshas Korach, of course, deals with the rebellion of Korach. Moshe was duly constituted authority, authorized by God. Korach was not happy. How come, he says, you're bossing everyone around? Ki chala eda kulam kedoshim. The people are all holy. Maduat is nasu al kahal Hashem. Why are you lording it over the Jewish people? Korach essentially was voicing some kind of populist, some kind of democratic notion that we should be in charge. We are the people. What right do you, as an autocrat, have to rule? Who says that you, who made you king? What right do you have to make all the decisions? We want to say. We want power. We want. We want to speak. We want to speak too. Korach, of course, is wrong. Korach pays for it. In this particular case, he was wrong because the answer to this question was God had appointed Moshe as king, as leader, and Korach, by his rebellion, was flouting, was rejecting the Nevuah. Nevuah's Moshe Rabbeinu was one of the fundamentals of Jewish faith. Obviously, Korach's claim did not have any validity. But in general, it's an interesting question. The general question about the role of democracy and the popular sovereignty, and specifically the right to revolution against the king, are interesting questions that I want to discuss today. First of all, turning to the right to revolution against the king. So we Americans, we learn in American history, world history, we learn in civics, we learn all about the right to revolution. Our country, the United States of America, is founded in a revolution. It was based on theoretical work of Enlightenment thinkers. It was expressed by people like Thomas Jefferson. Just to quote a little bit from John Locke, the theoretician of the Enlightenment, his view about the right to revolution. It's interesting because we're going to discuss soon Dov Abernethy's treatment of the subject several hundred years earlier. It is remarkable how the discussion he records between him and his Christian colleagues, how closely it tracks the discussion that we learn about in American history about the right to revolution. He writes that, so Locke wrote, the legislative being only a fiduciary power to act for certain ends, we appoint the government, they have limited power, there remains still in the people a supreme power to remove or alter the legislative, the ultimate power. This is the idea of consent to the governed, that the government's legitimacy, unlike the ancient doctrines of divine right, of kings. Locke was arguing that the authority, the sovereignty of the government derives from the ultimate sovereignty, which is vested in the people. When they find the legislative act contrary to the trust reposing them, they have the right to remove or alter the legislative. That's kind of sanitized language. It means they can revolt and depose and overthrow the king. He said, he explains, the lumdus is, for all power given with trust for the attaining an end, being limited by that end, we give the king the power, but only for the purposes of just and appropriate government. Whenever that end is manifestly neglected or opposed, the trust must necessarily be forfeited, and the power devolve into the hands of those that gave it. The power reverts back to the people. The language of Jefferson and the Declaration may be more familiar, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, the right of life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. Later he writes, not just the right to revolution, he writes, it's actually a duty to have revolutions. He writes, when a long train of abuses and usurpations, which he then lists, a mind-numbing list of King George III's abuses and usurpations, when they evince a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government. This was the idea of the Founding Fathers, the idea of the early Enlightenment thinkers, that the power of the government derives from the ultimate sovereignty of the people, and if he abuses his authority, if he abuses the power he's been given for the appropriate ends of governing society wisely and justly, the people have the right and the duty to overthrow him. So what does the Torah say about this? Do the people have the right to overthrow the justly established government if they feel he's abusing his authority? So the Avraham Avinu discusses this in Chumash Devarim, in Parsha Shoftim, I think, the Parsha of Som Tasim Alecha Melech. The Avraham Avinu is always, in my opinion, always at his best when he discusses anything to do with politics. He himself was a leading politician of his age. He was in the inner circle of the kings of Spain and Portugal. And he's always at his best when he's discussing high politics, court intrigue, and anything to do with advanced politics and civics back then. So he writes, when the Melech is a Ra Ublial, kind of the way they describe King George, when he's a Ra Ublial, so is it appropriate for them to rebel and overthrow him, throw out his kingdom? He says, he notes, Lo reinu b'divrei chachmei ameinu b'zeh davar. I haven't seen any earlier discussion in Jewish literature of this question about whether the king should be, whether the people have the right to overthrow the king. So then remarkably, remember this is the 15th century, remarkably, Rav Abravanel then records that he had a debate about this with the non-Jewish scholars of the time, Christians presumably, Christian courtiers, Christian scholars in the 15th century. He says, Chachmei Ha'umos discussed this question, and their conclusion was, like the Enlightenment thinkers of several centuries later, their conclusion was, it is appropriate to do what the tribes did to Rechavam, the son of Shlomo HaMelech, the famous Korach with his own special case, the idea of Moshe Rabbeinu, but the most famous question of a purely political revolt, very similar to our own revolution, was in the time of Rechavam, the son of Shlomo. It says, after David HaMelech and Shlomo HaMelech had the united kingdom of all the 12 Shvatim, it says that Rechavam tried to hold the kingdom together, and the people eventually rebelled, and just like we have the Boston Tea Party, the motives there were largely economic. They felt that the tax burden was too high, and they felt that the government was imposing an unbearably high financial burden on the people, and they revolted. So they're not even discussing whether they were right or wrong, but that's kind of the paradigm example of a revolt against the king for what they fail is his, what the people failed. It's his abuse of power. So the Chachmei Ha'umos, the non-Jewish scholars, debated this question, and they decided that revolution was appropriate, the exact train of thought of the Enlightenment thinkers later. V'ani dibarti b'drusha zeh lefnei malachim im chachameim. I discussed this question in the presence of kings and their courtiers. It's amazing how anybody got away in the 15th century with telling the king that we think the people have the right to revolt if you abuse your power. But he records that there was such a discussion. And he, the Abravanel, he takes the reactionary side. He says, nope, I demonstrated, she'eino meharoi, it is not appropriate. The people have no right to rebel. They have no right to toss the king out of power. Even if we concede, she'arshial, called Var Pesha, even if we concede that he's completely out of bounds, he's completely out of control and abusing his power. I argued, he says, the reactionary view that they have no right to depose the king, and I made three arguments, he says. Two of his arguments are general, they apply even to non-Jewish kings and non-Jewish governments. The third argument is specific to Jewish kings. So the third argument, which is specific to Jewish kings, is based on the idea that when the king is appointed, it's supposed to be with the participation of the Sanhedrin and Nevuah. He writes, the Torah says, Som tas melecha melech asher yivchar Hashem elokecha bo. The king is supposed to be selected based on Hashem's choice, Hashem's decision. Therefore, since it's up to him to select the king, it's up to him to fire the king. It's not the people's decision at all. Basically, the divine right of kings, but specifically with Jews, where we have genuine prophecy and we have authentic communication with God. So specifically with Jews, we have to assume that Hashem appoints and Hashem deposes, and it's not our job. This wouldn't necessarily apply to modern Jewish governments, which are obviously not appointed with direct prophecy, but at least in the time, the ideal method of Jewish governance, which was a king appointed by God through Nevuah, through the Sanhedrin, at least in that time, we have a specific argument why the people, the whole Enlightenment argument rests on the fact that the people derive their power by the social contract, by the consent of the governed. That's not the case, he says. In Judaism, we have the divine right of kings. The king, ideally at least, should be appointed and chosen by God. What's even more interesting, though, is his first two arguments, which are not specific to Jews and are not specific to prophecy. He argues on purely poli-sci grounds, it is unjustified for the people to overthrow the king. The first argument is, he says, the first argument is also based on the idea of the social contract, but where the later thinkers, where the non-Jews felt that the social contract has an implied condition, it's a contract. You live up to your side of the bargain and rule justly and wisely and for the best interest of the nation, and we live up to our side, which is to respect you and honor you and obey you. The contract is a two-way street, he says. So that's what the non-Jews held. That's what Locke and Jefferson held. If he doesn't live up to his side of the bargain, then the contract is void. Abravanel says no. The contract, the bris, he calls it, the covenant, is absolute. He says, einenu b'tnai, there is no tnai involved, ki'im amana mochletes, it is an absolute reposal of trust in the government. And he says the people are not the ones who get to decide whether he's acting rightly or wrongly. The people are completely subservient to him. The covenant is without any condition, and therefore they cannot depose him. Now, those who argued, again, we don't have the original, I don't have at least the original Christian thinkers he's debating, but those later Enlightenment thinkers who argued in favor of revolution, they did have to address this question. Who decides that the king is acting? Here 'tis like, says Locke, here 'tis like the common question will be made. Who shall be judged whether the prince or legislative act contrary to their trust? To this I reply, the people shall be judged. For who shall be judged whether his trustee or deputy acts well? In Lumdus and Halacha we would say you have a shliach and a mishaleach, you have an apotropos, a guardian. Who decides whether the shliach is living up to his, he who deputes him? And must, by having deputed him, have still a power to discard him when he fails in his trust. So, every man is judged for himself, etc. So, but the Rabbanel says no. The Rabbanel disagrees with this. The Rabbanel says no, the people cannot judge. The people, there's a category of Mori B'Malchus. If you challenge the king, you're a Mori B'Malchus. That, he says, fundamentally denies you the right to sit in judgment on the king, which is tantamount to saying, he says, that the bris, the covenant, is unconditional, absolute, irrevocable, and therefore, even insofar as we accept that the legitimacy of the government derives from the consent of the governed, the initial consent is absolute, and there's no further power to depose it. He has a second argument based on an analogy between human rule and divine rule. I'm not going to get into that, but in general, this was Abravanel's view. As he himself testifies, he doesn't know of anyone who's discussed the question before him, and I personally, I'm not familiar with anyone who discusses the question after him, so I don't know if his position was accepted among later Jewish thinkers, not accepted. But in any event, this is the remarkably reactionary view of the Abarbanel, that revolution is absolutely, unequivocally illegitimate and inappropriate. So right. Well. I think in political science, reactionary is a term that means basically conservative, anti-progressive, anti-revolution. I'm not sure the etymology of the word, but I know that's how the word is used. And conservative is a word I guess we're more familiar with today. But they sometimes use the word reactionary. He wants to know about the hereditary property of the monarchy. Kings in halacha are hereditary. Obviously, you can argue that the case for the absolute social contract is not as strong when you're dealing with the son, because we never agreed to the son. I guess the counter argument would be that by agreeing to a hereditary monarch, you're implicitly agreeing to the son. It's an interesting question. I don't know. He doesn't directly address that, but it's an interesting question. I don't have anything directly to say on that.
Getting sort of back to this question about whether the position that he's taking is a reactionary one or not. So I don't know specifically about Spain or Roman time, but the general pattern in the medieval world is that Jews were under the protection of the king, and the kings were generally less anti-Semitic than the barons and the people. So to what extent, if any, do you think that colored the upper
world? So he's making a fair point, which is that historically, as a matter of actual history, whatever the theoretical reason for this is, the kings, the national kings, were often substantially more protective of the rights and the persons of the Jews than the local dukes, the local feudal aristocrats were. Matter of fact, I always like to point out, in the Rama tells us in the laws of Gittin that when Jews used to write get when a Jew would write a get in Krakow, I think, so the Jewish neighborhood, the Jewish ghetto neighborhood in Krakow was called something like Kazmirs, Kuf Zayin Mem Yud Reishin in Hebrew, Kazmirs. And the custom was the Jews in a get, you write the place of the get's being written, the place where the husband and wife are from. So usually you write the general city name. Sometimes we write the local neighborhood name, and it's often a subject of great controversy. In Baltimore and Boston, there were major controversies about whether to write the city name, New York. There's always a question about when you write the local kind of sub-city or neighborhood name versus the city name. So in Krakow, the Rama tells us the custom used to be the Jews would not write Krakow, they would write Kazmirs. He doesn't say why. So I saw several centuries later in Rabbi Leo Kolaskin's Tshuvas, he was a great Gaon of Poland, he mentions this minhag. He says that they used to write Kazmirs and not Krakow. And he says the reason why is well known. He says the Jewish neighborhood was called Kazmirs because it was in honor of the great king Kazimir. Now, I don't know my Polish history that well. There were, I think, a number of kings named Kazimir. It was a popular Polish royal name. And one or two of them in particular, Casimir the Great, and at least, I think more than one, were particularly good to the Jews. But anyway, Sir Bleo Kalaskin says that that King Casimir had been a great protector of the Jews, in other words, a protector against the local, vicious anti-Semitic small players in the local towns. And as a Hakaras HaTov to King Casimir, the Jews deliberately wrote in their gittin, we find in the Gemara, Shalom Malchus, they used to honor the king by using his name where possible. So there was a custom that became enshrined in halacha for centuries to write Casimir's in honor of the King Casimir, who often was a great protector, as we find. So yes, it is true that the kings were often the buffer against the excesses of the locals. So yeah, how that played into his argument is certainly an interesting question. Yes, that Barbanel. Yeah, the Barbanel, as we mentioned earlier, was in the elites of his time. He actually, he fell in and out of favor. He describes in the beginning of his commentary to Yeshua, he describes a hair-raising straight out of a thriller, midnight chase through the. Basically, he says he was in favor in the court, and then the new king came, and his enemies began to whisper poisonous slander into the king's ear that he was a traitor. Finally, they won over the suspicious, nervous king. So he said at one point he gets a letter saying the king wants to see you immediately, and I think he got a tip off from someone else inside that you're going straight to jail or the guillotine or whatever. So he says he didn't even go home. He basically got on his horse and he dashed straight for the border with the king's men in hot pursuit right behind him. He says he just barely got over the border. This is Barbanel himself. He writes this himself in the beginning of his commentary to Yeshua or the Nevi'im Achronim. He says, and he had to leave his family behind. He says it wasn't, I think, till a year, months or years later he was able to negotiate for their release. So yeah, the Mishnah Pirkei Avos already tells you that be careful about becoming Karav L'Malchus because they have ulterior motives and it's not always the safest thing to do. So yeah, so Barbanel was, he was actually in the inner circle of kings more than once, first Spain, then Portugal, Italy, I think later, but he actually was an insider, and again, it'd be an interesting question to figure out how that. Yeah, so it's difficult to know how his own experiences helped shape his views on the topic. But in any event, the only Jewish thinker that I'm aware, or early Jewish thinker on record that I'm aware of, is this treatment of the Barbanel. Moving now away from kings and revolution to the general attitude of Judaism toward democracy. So we find discussions of democracy and halacha in two or three contexts in different areas of halacha. Halacha generally assumes, takes for granted, that a rough democratic process is the way to go, putting aside the actual discussion of monarchs in general, in local governments, and even sometimes in national government. Halacha kind of takes for granted that a sort of democratic majoritarian process is the way to go. This manifests itself in a number of different contexts in halacha. One is local government. So in the Gemara, we don't have much talk about local government. We have discussions of Melech, the sovereign. We don't have that much talk about what today would be the equivalent of state and local government. But in the medieval period, a little bit in the Talmud, but in the medieval period, both in Ashkenaz and in Sfarad, in Spain, France, Germany, we do find an explosion of discussion about local government because sometimes halakha has to follow the way the practical society evolves. In those times, the Jews did not have sovereign governments. They did have local government. And very often, the national government gave the Jewish community autonomy or semi-autonomy. They had to govern themselves. They had the right, the privilege, the duty to govern themselves. So out of necessity, a fairly complex, fairly sophisticated literature arose discussing the rules and procedures for local government. One of the central sources on this topic is a tshuva of the Maram of Rottenberg. The Maram was kind of asked indirectly. I don't know what his questioner knew, didn't know, what he took for granted, what he didn't take for granted. The question was your basic question of governance. So we can't reach a consensus. What should we do? The question was, the community has kitata, has disagreements. They can't reach a consensus. To make decisions. And things are getting things are falling apart because we can't move forward because we can't reach any consensus. So what should we do? How should we decide?
Is this a government issue or a community issue?
It's a community issue, but essentially it's the equivalent of local government. City government. We're going to see that the Maram was talking about what we would essentially call government powers to pass rules, to regulate trade, to collect taxes, to spend tax revenues. These were questions that the context was largely community, but the framework of both the question and the answer were essentially governmental questions. How should we decide? So he says, what you do is as follows. The procedure is you have a meeting of all the balabatim shenos nimas. We'll discuss this more in a minute, but all the householders that pay taxes, the 47% or the 53%, I always forget which was which. Everyone pays taxes besides federal income tax. But he says you get together everyone who pays taxes, and they make a commitment that they're all going to express their opinion l'shem shemayim. We may not have time to get into what that means, but in any event, you have a meeting of all the taxpayers, and everyone expresses his opinion about what should be done on these questions of who to appoint for chazanim, for municipal officials, how to establish a kis shel tzedakah. We would call this entitlements or social spending or limnos gabayim to appoint other kinds of officers, livnos and listar, construction, infrastructure, beis hakneses, synagogue construction. The synagogues then weren't necessarily private like ours were, supported by their membership. They were often supported by the community, with some powers of government, etc. He says, he goes on like this. He says, sof dover, the general rule is, kol tzarech hakahal, any need of the community should be done al pihem, based on a vote to have representative government, to elect representatives. He said, everyone has to listen. If the minority won't listen, we force them to. They have to listen to the rov. So we follow basically majority rule, either a direct vote of majority rule or the majority votes to elect representatives, and those representatives make decisions, and that is how things are done. Now, the Talmud has already discussed in various places what to do about the Balabastra. The Gemara talks about things the city needs. They can force each other to contribute. If the city needs a wall or if it needs certain types of infrastructure, the city has the right to force recalcitrant members to participate, but it doesn't explain how you decide what's a need, what's not a need. Maram is filling that gap in by telling you, if we don't know what's a legitimate need, if we don't know whether a certain project, a certain enterprise should be done, we decide by having a vote, by having a democratic majority rule decide what needs to be done and what should not be done. Now, as we noted, the Maram, when he discusses who's eligible to vote, he says, kol balabatim. Balabatim basically meant just, you know, citizens of the community who had households. Shenos nemas. He says that the ones who are eligible to vote are the ones who pay taxes. The implication is, and this is discussed by the poskim, those who do not pay taxes do not vote. And the understanding seems to be that the areas we're talking about here were areas of financial matters. How to tax, who to tax, how much to tax, how to spend, what to spend the money on. And basically, they were all financial questions, and the Rishonim took for granted, generally, that making decisions about people's money, the money should be made, but the decision should be made by those whose money was being spent. This is not the attitude we have today. In the modern United States, it would be out of the question to say that only people who are paying money, only people who have money should vote. But this actually was the opinion, again, turning back to our founding fathers, this actually was the opinion of many of the leading thinkers of the American Revolution. John Jay used to say, those who own the country ought to govern it. The rich, the people who had a financial stake in it, and even James Madison, the greatest theorist, arguably, of practical government, he repeatedly was worried about tyranny of the majority. If the unwashed masses who didn't have money, if they would just vote to take away all the rich people's money. That was why they established the Senate, to represent not just absolute majority rule. And Madison wrote at length about the importance of not allowing a simple majority, because it wouldn't be fair. That's why you needed constitution and rights. It wouldn't be fair to simply allow the majority to override the people who actually had the money. He talked about this repeatedly. If elections were open to all classes of people, the property of the landed proprietors would be insecure. Landholders ought to have a share of the government to support these invaluable interests and to balance and check the others. So he says, Meissner says, we have a problem. He says, going too much to one side is not fair. He says, allow the right exclusively to property. Only people who had money can vote. The rights of other persons might be oppressed. Feudal policy alone sufficiently proves that, he says. Extended equally to all, like we do today, voting completely independently of property, then the rights of property might be overruled by a majority without property. So therefore, somehow you have to have some balanced system, he says. There are various ways in which the rich may oppress the poor, in which property may express liberty, he says. The poor should have a defense against the danger. On the other hand, the danger to the holders of property cannot be disguised if they be undefended against the majority without property. And so on and so forth. So he spent a lot of time trying to figure out how the government could be structured in such a way that while the danger of the rich oppressing the poor is obvious, there's also a serious danger the other direction, that the poor can oppress the rich. So he struggled to figure out how to do that. And that's what the Rishonim are dealing with over here also. They say we can't simply allow everyone to vote because people who have money clearly should have more of a say in how that money should be taxed and spent. So the Maram doesn't give you much in the way of detail. He just says that the people eligible to vote, are those who are nos nimas. This basic theme is picked up and elaborated on by other Rishonim. So the Rush talks about, the Rush was the Maram's Talmud, Rabbeinu Asher. The Rush wants to know, what do you do, assuming you follow the Rove, do you follow Rove people, Rove bodies? Or do you follow Rove Mammon, most of the money, even if the Ashirim, the rich, are the Muat, the 1%? Do you say they're 1% of people, or they have 99% of wealth? Do they count as 1% or 99%? That was the Shiloh of the Rush. One man, one vote, $1, one vote. Which system is more appropriate? So the Rush says, you follow Rove Mammon. That, again, like the Maram, it's not fair, it doesn't make sense, he says, that most people should be able to dispose of the money of the 1% as they see fit. You have to follow Rove Mammon. And the Rush is not entirely clear what he means. The Raman, Shulchan Aruch, who basically codifies this ruling of the Rush, that you have to follow Rove Mammon, the language of the Raman is, Kol Mashagovin L'fi HaMammon, when taxes are collected L'fi HaMammon, this is not even a progressive tax, this is simply a percentage tax. If you tax everyone at a flat rate of 15%, that's called L'fi HaMammon. You're collecting most of the taxes from the rich, because they have most of the money. So Holchanach HaRov HaMammon, you follow Rov Mammon, and the Ashirim, which are the Miut Nefashos, the rich, who are, in terms of bodies, in terms of people, are still the Miut, Heim Chashuvim Rov Benin Zev. They're considered the majority. Now, it's not so simple. The Sma learns, more like Madison was saying, the Sma learns that the Russian really means to say there's a deadlock. He means to say that Rov Mammon counts more or less equivalent to, balances out, Rov Nefashos. So if you have Rov Nefashos saying one way, and Rov Mammon saying the other way, it's Chashuv and Mechzel Mechzel. That's considered two equal positions, and they have to reach some compromise. And, you know, compromise sometimes works, sometimes doesn't work. Divided government sometimes is effective, sometimes it's not. He doesn't say it. They have to negotiate. They have to reach some agreement. The two factions have to...
What's another alternative?
They'll agree to pay maybe more than 1%, but less than 99%. How much? I mean, they'll agree to pay 30%, 50%, 60%. I don't know what they'll do, but yeah, they'll have to work it out. It's like in the Senate. If you need 60 votes to pass something, and each party has, you know, roughly 50 seats, and you're not going to get anything done without working out an agreement, a political skill, negotiating skill, creative skill, whatever you do, but somehow you have to reach a...
The consequence of that holding is that the rich will have to somehow subsidize those.
Yeah, so there's no question that they're not going to have their way, and that's what this man is saying, they're not going to have their way entirely. The Rush can't be taken at face value that the rich completely make the decisions. Again, they're not giving you the most practical guide for workable government, but at least in principle, the fundamental assumptions they're explaining, that you have to follow the claims both of Rove Mammon as well as Rove Nefashos. The Mishnah Melech also objects to taking the Rush at face value. He says it can't be. He says Lo Yitachin Shekol HaTzibur Yukufim L'Shnei Ashirim Shparam Rove Mammon. It doesn't make sense that the oligarchs, that the few people, the Walton family and two or three others who own most of the country's wealth, should be able to completely make public policy on their own, even financial policy. That just can't be. That's just too much, he says.
Robert, there's one thing is about how you manage assets, how you manage money, and the other thing is how you establish administration. So he's talking about how you determine who's going to rule, or how you determine how you spend the money.
So most of the questions here were money. Again, like we said, this was not national government, this was local government. Most of the issues involve taxing and spending. Spending money either for communal needs like synagogue construction, maybe hospital construction.
Okay, so the rabbi doesn't have anything to do here?
That's a good question. The Gemara itself talks about Shiva Tuvei Ha'er B'Ma'am at Chacham Ha'er, that the Chacham in certain cases for the passing of certain types of edicts and laws, the Chacham has to be involved. That is an important topic. I don't have that in my notes here. I'm not going to get into that today, but yes, I don't have that prepared. But there is discussion about the Chacham too. He does play a role, but beyond the scope of today's talk. So again, the Mishnah Melech also has problems with this notion that the Rosh can't be taken at face value, that the rich rule entirely. But he says, so again, there has to be some kind of... He doesn't give you, again, an exact recipe for what to do, but he says that... So again, this is generally, I think, the position of Achronim, that it's not strictly one man, one vote, but it's also not strictly $1, one vote. It is something in between, although exactly what that balance is not entirely clear. Now, the argument here for giving the rich more power than other individuals is based simply on the fact, not that the rich are in any way smarter, wiser, more just than the poor. It's simply that it's their money, so they should have more of a say in its disposition, distribution. I recently bumped into a tshuva of the Marashdam, Shmuel Di Medina, a leading Sephardic, leading Turkish authority in the 16th century. He has a tshuva which I actually find deeply disturbing. He rules that the rich get more votes because they are wiser and simply somehow a better class of people than the poor, which arguably was the opinion of many of the founding fathers too, that the people who were educated and, you know, the upper class, even in America where they didn't have the aristocracy of England, you know, they did have the belief that people of quality, people who were from the upper crust of society, were the ones who should govern, certainly in the South. That was the attitude. But we find the Marashdam basically arguing for roughly the same position. There's the, you know, there's that line about from Fitzgerald, I think. He said the rich are different from you and me. I forget which comedian had the comeback. Like, yeah, they have more money, but Marashdam said no, the rich are different from you and me. Not from him, but from us at least. He said that the rich are different. The rich are deserving inherently of more of a vote, simply because they are simply a higher class of people, and their opinion deserves to be taken into account. The question he was asked was, there is a kahal that has ashirim, benonim, and aniim, a real class, you know, Marxist kind of setup. There are the rich, there are the middle class, there's the poor. So, and also there are this began to your question about the Torah scholars who are also from the chachamim. So the question was, when they have votes, when they appoint a shlech tzibur or a rav or other communal needs, so he says, should we follow a simple rov without looking to the quality of the voter? Or should we somehow distinguish between people, between the rich and between the chachamim and the ordinary people? So he says emphatically, vehemently, we absolutely must take into account the quality of the people. Certainly the chachamim and even the rich get more of a say. He doesn't define exactly how much of a say again, but he says certainly it is logically necessary that we give them more of a say. It's true that people have this kind of simplistic democratic idea that acharabim lahatos means Nishma Levnei Adam means absolute majority, majority rule. It's not that way, he says. One example he brings is the Gemara about Beisham and Beis Hillel. The Gemara says, even though Beis Hillel was the Rov, the school of Hillel was numerically superior to the school of Shammai, but the school of Shammai balanced it out by being Mechadid Yitzvei. They were sharper, more acute. So you see that it's not all numbers. That quality and acuity is taken into account too. So he says, that's a good point. We do pass like Beis Hillel.
Most.
Not always, right? Not always, but in general, we do pass like Beis Hillel. And apparently, the simple reading of the Gemara also talks about a baskol and other things. But yes, bring a raya from Mechadid Yitzvei, it's not clear that's the maskana of the Gemara, but he brings it at least as conceptually that there is such an idea. And then he says, certainly the Torah scholars, their opinion should be certainly when it comes to religious questions, certainly if you're dealing with the opinion of a Torah scholar on a religious question, certainly his opinion should be taken more into account than that of the general population. And he says, Sof Dover, he says, to simply follow the tyranny of the majority, with the way the Hamon thinks, to follow the majority, not deviating Yeminu Smol from the majority, is untenable, he says. You can't do that. Chas v'shalom, umken yilok hamidas adin. He says, you know, again, Madison's concerned. Tyranny of the majority, says, Yamdu be'er echad or kol echad, one city, one community will have 100 people. 10 of them are nechbadei aretz, upper class, chashuvim, vashirim, better people, so to speak. V'tishim anashim, dalas ha'am. Rabble, the 99%, 90% in his case, he says the 90% will want to point somebody, make decisions, he says. Chalila, how can that be? It's against logic, it's unfair, it's preposterous, he says. He says, Kvar Darashti L'Rabim, I've gotten up in public and said that the Torah calls the Ashirim the Punim, like the face, they're the ones who should lead. Everyone else is the Acharayim, everyone else are the followers, the rich people lead, everyone else follows. He goes on and he says, Lamadnu, Shabbatal Das Hamamunim, Haomrim Machrizim Rov, those who say majority, no matter what, populism, the majority has to rule, that is wrong, that is Batal. He says, Chamisha Yud Anoshim Chashuvim, 5 or 10 Chashuv people, distinguished people, Olam La'elef, here we've actually reached the 99 and the 1%, 10 to 1,000 or even 5 to 1,000, half a percent, the 0.5%, the half of 1%, he's right, are worth elef, he says, bein mitzad ha-chachma, whether their uniqueness, whether their expertise is based on chachma, bein mitzad ha-osher. Osher also counts, similar to chachma, he says, ki ha-osher karov l'malas ha-chachma, being rich is like being wise. The Torah compares wisdom to wealth, and so on and so forth, and that is his position. Very hard, I think, for us to stomach.
All the land had to be go back to the Did anybody ever come up with an idea? All the money from when you over to that, you got to redistribute
all the wealth, not just real estate. You mean? So I did see. He's pointing out that the Torah said that in the Yovel, in the 50th year, so all sales of real estate, all transferred, so nobody could accumulate too much real estate because it would all revert to its shaven owner. He wants to know if there's any extension of that to general property, cash, securities, animals. Do we ever find any kind of general systematic, today, income inequality, asset inequality? Is there any provision in the Torah to kind of push everything back toward a more equal distribution of assets? So the one thing that comes to mind on this, there's an interesting discussion in the Urim V'Tumim of Yonatan Eibschitz. He's talking about the mitzvah of Shemitah, of cancellation of debts. So the different Jewish thinkers have offered various suggestions about what the rationale of the Torah is, why debts are canceled. So the Urim V'Tumim really argues that the Torah doesn't want kind of endless buildup of business. He doesn't say it's for income inequality, for wealth inequality. He says the reason is the Torah doesn't want you to get too caught up in business, doesn't want you to build financial empires and spend your whole life amassing wealth. The Torah wants everything to be inherently temporary, inherently kind of short-term subsistence, enough to live, but not amassing. His concern is not with societal inequality. His concern is with a person should remember that serving God is the primary goal, and everything else is kind of inherently short-term, inherently as necessary, but not... But the idea, Shemitas Ksafim, the idea that debts are canceled, again, debt cancellation of debts is still not going to erase asset inequality or income inequality, but it is one step in that direction but I don't know of really a more general halacha or value of leveling out the income, but it's a good question. But in general, so this is the position of the Marashnam. I remember in Fiddler on the Roof, Tevye is daydreaming about if I were a rich man, about everyone, they would ask me questions like I were Solomon the Wise, if you please, Reb Tevye, answer me, Reb Tevye. So And it's true, you know, there are common sayings in Yiddish and Jewish culture about Mishi Yesh Lo Me'ah, Yesh Lo De'ah, that rich people get to... But the truth is, Marashdam is telling us that is an authentic halachic value. Rich people do get to have more of a say, they, not just as a practical matter, but they deserve to have more of a say. Doesn't sit so well, I think, with us moderns as much, but you know, that's the opinion of the Marashdam.
The line is that if you're rich, they think you really know.
There you go. Marashdam says you do really know. Just cover one last area where democracy comes into halacha. That this is really a topic deserves its own talk, separate occasion. But that is in the famous principle of dina d'malchus dina. We have a couple of gemaras and extensive literature in the poskim about the rule of dina d'malchus dina, that the law of the land is recognized by halacha as being binding, as being valid. They're not simply robber barons who collect tax money from you because they have the guns, but because they have the halacha recognizes their authority, certainly the right to collect taxes, and there's a great deal of discussion about how far the din malchusa goes. Not for today. But in general, halacha has a principle of din malchusa dina. What is that based on? What is the source? Why does halacha recognize the power of sovereign governments? Why does it, certainly in financial matters, why does halacha accept their rules, their legislation, their taxation as being binding? But there are a number of different theories in the Rishonim and Achronim, a number of psukim, drushes, theories, svaras. One of the most famous and one of the most widely accepted by the poskim is that of the Rashbam, one of the Balei Tosis, Rashi's grandson. The Rashbam writes, Dinin Malchus Adina, why? So the Rashbam says, Shekol b'nei ha-malchus mekablam aleihem eretzonam chukei ha-melech, all the inhabitants of a country, all the citizens, they willingly accept the authority of the king and his laws. Hilkach din gomeru. That's what gives, this is again, back to the beginning of our discussion, back to the social contract and consent of the governed. The Rashbam takes the fairly modern view that the legitimacy of a government, the legitimate authority of government derives from consent of the governed. And that is why halacha recognizes the law of the sovereign government as binding, because it has the consent of the governed. The government. So again, the Rashbam svara wouldn't seem to apply as much in a dictatorship and someone who rules by force without any kind of consent, but at least in a normal, you know, again, it's not necessarily dealing with a democracy in the modern sense, but at least once people have accepted it, and grudgingly, maybe willingly, it may not be their first choice, but once Lamaisa, there is a general acceptance of the government. He was talking about the governments of old in Talmudic times, which are certainly not generally democracies. And nevertheless, the Rashbam fails, and in some sense, the legitimacy of the government derives from consent of the governed, and that is the basis of the principle of Dina Malchus Adina. Now, we have discussion in the modern poskim in the 20th century about Bechlal. Should Dina Malchus Adina, should that principle be applied at all to modern democratic governments? Should the principle be limited? Chazal talked about a malchus, a melech. Melech says this, melech says that. Should the whole principle of Dina Malchus Adina be applied to democratic governments? So all that Quranim says that if you start with the Rashbam, that even the non-democratic, even the autocratic governments of old, even their legitimacy derived from some kind of social contract, consent of the governed idea, then certainly alakas kama v'kama, modern democratic governments should have the same legitimacy, even more legitimacy, because they certainly have consent of the governed. The system is not perfect, you know, the voting is not perfect, but it's certainly the ordinary man has much more say in the government in spite of money and advertising and the rich and parties and lobbyists and all that. At the end of the day, the ordinary citizen has much more say and influence in his government than he did under Henry the whoever was in charge in the Magna Carta period. So certainly the post can generally assume that modern democratic governments do enjoy the power of Dina Malchus Adina, certainly according to the explanation of the Rashbam. Now, even though there are a number of other understandings of Dina Malchus Adina, not based on democracy, and those might apply less so to, on the contrary, those might seem to apply to a lesser extent to modern democracies. For example, one of the other competing theories of Dina Malchus Adina is almost the opposite. The Rashbam is based on consent of the governed. Many of the Balei Tosfos had a theory which was almost diametrically opposed to that, antipodal to that. They argued that Dina Malchus Adina is based on the king owns the entire country. He is the boss. It's his land. If you don't like it, leave. It's his property. If you want to come into my house, I tell you, these are the rules. Take off your shoes before stepping on the carpet. My house, my rules. You don't like it, don't come into my house. So the many of the Rishonim said, government works the same way. The government owns the country. If you don't like it, find yourself a different country. Now that, the Poskim argue, would seem to apply much less so in a modern democracy. On the contrary, the property is the people's property. The government might have certain rights, but, you know, quartering soldiers, the government's right to stick a soldier in your house was one of the key, one of the key arguments that led to the Revolutionary War. The government does not have the right to infringe on the private property of citizens. It's not governmental property. So many modern Poskim did raise this question about whether, according to that and other theories of Din Malchus HaDina, perhaps it shouldn't apply to modern governments where the king is not the emperor, the king is not the owner of the country, and maybe Din Malchus should not apply. But generally speaking, even those Poskim agree that democracy itself can also be the basis for Din Malchus HaDina. Again, our governments have less power from the perspective of autocrats who own the country, but they have more power insofar as their power actually derives from the consent of the governed. So we have a fairly good consensus of modern Poskim from the, basically from the latter half of the 20th century, arguing that our governments have to be respected because they represent the will of the people. Halacha recognizes that as a valid source of authority. Rav Henkin, for example, in America, Rav Henkin actually has an even more innovative theory. Rav Henkin says that even though the language of some Rishonim is that the king can expel you from the land, so if you remain there at his pleasure and you're bound by his laws, he says, we shouldn't take that so literally. We don't mean the government literally has the right to expel you. That's not required. He says the mere fact that you benefit from the government, he says they provide security, he says constant security, they provide, he says, subsidized food, water, subsidized electricity. I'm not sure, why these are so, this is a very kind of socialist view of government, that their job is to provide basic food, goods, and services to the public at subsidized, below cost. They provide infrastructure, he says, gesharim, udrachim, bridges and roads, and so on. He says certainly that itself gives them the right, the authority for their legislation to be binding. For other poskim, even though we don't go quite so far, we don't argue for a kind of socialist view of government. Even other poskim simply say the mere fact that the government rules today at the pleasure of the, by the consent of the governed, that itself grants them legitimacy. Rav Shmuel David Monk, the Pa'as Sadcha, he says, do we apply Din Malchus HaDina in modern democracies? He says, according to some of the theories, perhaps not. But he says certainly, based on at least some of these theories, based on the idea that he serves at the consent of the governed, he says, He himself actually is not convinced that consent of the governed is such a major factor, but most other poskim are. We have Rav Avadia Yosef and others. We have Rav Elazar Meir Prial and Elizabeth. He talks about what do we do, he says, for a Shilton Amami, Republic, Reish Yud Pei Vav Beis Lamed Yud Kuf. What do we do by Democratic government, Republican government? He says, they don't own the karka, they can't expel you, he says. Maybe they can block immigrants, he says. That power they have, they certainly can't expel a citizen. They can't deprive a citizen of his property without due process. So he says that, again, he says that, according to some opinions, particularly the Rashbam, he says, certainly, he says, Koach HaTzibur v'Heskem HaKlali Shayachim Gam B'Shilton Amami, the sovereign power of the people, the general consensus applies to a democratic government. That's what the Rashbam is saying, and he therefore felt that modern democratic government should certainly have the power of Din Malchus HaDina. Rav Avadia Yosef also said that even in Chavadat, even in a government that doesn't have a king, that has a Memshala Nivcheret Al Yedei Toshvei HaMedina, that has a government chosen by the citizens, we certainly say Din Malchus HaDina, and all the, this is the consensus of virtually all poskim. There are some poskim who argue that in Eretz Yisrael things are a little different for various reasons. There are some poskim who argue that even in modern governments in general, in the United States, other democratic and non-democratic countries, there is Din Malchusa, whether democratic or not. There are those who have tried to argue that in Eretz Israel there is no application of Din Malchusa Dina. For various reasons. One reason is, again, because based on this idea of Haaretz Shaloh, that the king owns the land and he can expel you at will, Eretz Yisrael is inalienably the property of the Jewish people. He can't expel you, things are different. But even there, most poskim have said that given that there is democracy, consent to the govern, most poskim say that that anyway grants the government legitimacy and their laws are valid. So generally the consensus of major poskim, with some exceptions, particularly in the B'nai Brak Chazon Ish school, who disagree, but in general, the fact that they have a democratic government means there is Din Malchusa, in spite of the fact that unfortunately the government often doesn't do what the Torah expects them to do, not observant, doesn't have policies required by the Torah. In general, as Rav Ezra Batri and Rav Adya Sefer and others have argued, that does not take away their legitimacy. There were kings in the time of Chazal that were certainly, in the time of the Tanakh, that were certainly Rishayim and Avodah Zarah. They still were recognized as the duly recognized sovereigns. Certainly the non-Jewish governments in the ancient periods, the Romans, the Greeks, the Persians, were not paragons of democratic virtue or civic virtue of any sort. Nevertheless, they were recognized as the legitimate authorized sovereign, and that, I think, is the consensus position of contemporary poskim.